The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Monday, July the 7th, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, Brown backtracks on biofuels at the G8 summit in Japan.
Brown's not the only one to have seen biofuels as an answer to climate change. And I think that everybody was surprised by how sharply food prices have increased over the last couple of years. I think, you know, it's something of an embarrassment to all the countries which have invested heavily in biofuels.
We learn the Tory solution to our petrol problems, but will it work?
I might side with the Tories in thinking they may be able to bring something off, but I don't quite believe it's going to be as good as they say.
Life behind barbed wire, the Great West Bank divide.
You see a Palestinian community neighbouring to a settlement, but both are looking to each other as enemies, not as friends, as neighbours. This is the problem with wall and separation, and this is why we say the wall in the end will create hatred.
Plus, we hear about the Battle of the Battlefields and celebrate success at Silverstone.
It was Hamilton's ability to, you know, find his way between the puddles and drive extremely fast while not doing the stupid things that some of the other drivers were doing. It was enormously impressive.
But first, we have a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
People in Britain must stop wasting food if living costs are to fall, according to Gordon Brown. The Prime Minister was speaking to journalists en route to the G8 conference in Japan, which begins today. This year's summit is likely to be dominated by food and energy, and Gordon Brown will also call for investment in African food production and for a moratorium on some biofuels. More to come on this later on Guardian Daily. A suicide bomber has struck in Afghanistan's capital city, Kabul. The explosion, which happened earlier this morning outside the Indian Embassy near the Interior Ministry, has killed at least 7 people. Meanwhile, in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, a suicide bomber has killed at least 10 people and injured dozens more. The bombing in Pakistan marked the first anniversary of the military operation against the city's radical Red Mosque and targeted police guarding the site. 5 people have been arrested over the murder of 16-year-old Shakilis Townsend, who was beaten and stabbed to death in South London last week. Those arrested include a 16-year-old girl and 2 teenage boys. The attack brought the number of teenagers murdered in London this year to 18. The arrests over the weekend came as tributes and pictures posted on the internet suggested the murdered teenager was caught up in London's gang culture. The Church of England's ruling body, the General Synod, is set to vote today for the conditions under which women can be made bishops. The plan would create a new tier of clergy, which have already been labelled super bishops. The row could split the church, and more than 1,000 traditionalist clergy have threatened to leave over the issue. In sport, Rafael Nadal has been crowned Wimbledon champion after a mammoth 5-set victory over Roger Federer. Nadal became the first Spaniard to win the title and ended Federer's grip on the trophy he's held since 2003. And in Formula One, Lewis Hamilton won the British Grand Prix with a masterful display of wet weather driving at Silverstone. Hamilton now has a joint lead with Ferrari drivers Kimi Raikkonen and Felipe Massa in the championship. Turning now to today's papers, and the Telegraph reports that Gordon Brown faces a challenge to his leadership if Labour loses the Glasgow East by-election later this month. Labour's current majority is over 13,000, but some bookmakers have made the Scottish National Party favourites to win the seat. The Times quotes new research that shows infertile men can more than double their chances of fatherhood with a new IVF technique. The Daily Mail reports more than £1.7 billion of lottery cash intended for good causes is still waiting to be spent. The FT splashes with news that George Bush has insisted that any agreements on climate change measures at the G8 summit will depend on the participation of China and India. The Sun carries an interview with Tory leader David Cameron, who pledges to jail anyone caught carrying a knife if his party are elected. The Daily Express is concerned the summer will be a washout. The paper's front page predicts weeks of downpours. And the Mirror stokes up more fears about knife crime with news that a 10-year-old boy has been accused of robbing a 9-year-old girl at knife point in London. The back pages, and indeed many of the front ones, carry large pictures of a delighted Wimbledon champion, Rafael Nadal. More news and sports throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
First, Gordon Brown has flown to Japan to join the world's top industrialised nations to debate the global challenge of rising fuel and food prices and climate change. President Bush got there ahead of the Prime Minister and spoke about his priorities for the summit.
We'll talk about food and energy, of course,
I've got two other subjects that I want to make sure we spend a fair amount of time on. One is the Doha round. It's an opportunity for us to promote free and fair trade. And then I'm going to spend some time, of course, sharing my views about the environment and how we can, you know, advance our common agenda and that remind people that the United States and Japan have, really do lead the world in research when it comes to clean technologies, and that I anticipate our country will be able to be using battery technologies in automobiles that look like cars, not golf carts, and which will save us a lot of, you know, reliance upon oil.
While he's in Japan, Gordon Brown is hoping to put the brakes on biofuels. He's calling for a moratorium on plant-derived fuel to help stabilise food prices. We spoke to our economics editor, Larry Elliott, about the PM's plans halfway through his trip to Hokkaido.
We're in the middle of Siberia, I think, a place called Novosibirsk, which, looking out the window, appears to be an oil town. I couldn't be 100% certain, but it's sort of halfway between London and Hokkaido, and we've had to refuel because this is a smaller plane than would normally be carrying the Prime Minister's party to Japan. But apparently the reason for that, as I'm told, is that when the BA plane crashed at Heathrow earlier this year, it took out the one spare plane in the BA fleet, and that was the one that was customarily used for Prime Ministerial visits. So they've just had to go and hire a new one from somewhere else. This one's actually an American charter flight. I think it normally flies the Dallas basketball team around.
All right, then, two matters global now. This is the G8. Obviously, they're discussing the world economy, the agenda this year. Well, maybe you could talk us through the agenda.
It's kind of like a Back to the Future summit in a way. When the summits were first set up in the 1970s, it was because the world economy was in crisis because of a big increase in the oil price. And for an awful long time, when things were good, the G8 used to busy itself with other things. But it's back to the bread and butter issue this year, which is the state of the global economy. Obviously, a lot of the G8 countries, America, Britain, and probably Europe too, are feeling the pinch from the credit crunch and from very rapid increases in fuel prices and food prices. So those are the three big items on the agenda this year, and those are the things that Brown really wants to get to grips with this week in Japan. His argument is that these are global problems and need global solutions, and the G8 is a good place to start dealing with them.
And of course, there's a government report coming out on biofuels. This is a topic which Gordon Brown has been at the vanguard of. Now, as I understand it, he's calling to put the brakes on it.
I think he's taking a more nuanced approach, certainly. I mean, I think that his view is that perhaps some of the hype around biofuels was overdone in the past. And he's, I think, concerned that we're going to be 180 degrees from being totally in favour of biofuels to being completely against them. The Prime Minister's argument is that there are good biofuels and bad biofuels. I think this Gallagher report on biofuels is going to point up some of the potential problems in biofuels. So I think that we are going to see a rather more nuanced debate about whether biofuels could be used as part of a balanced strategy for dealing with climate change. I think that there's absolutely no doubt that the drive for biofuels, so pell-mell rush for biofuels, has actually been one of the factors which has driven up food prices. And I think that all the G8 countries and developing countries are starting to have some doubts about whether this is really a particularly wonderful strategy.
And on your charter flight out to Japan, the Prime Minister has come back to talk to the likes of you. He's been talking about the Labour Party meeting with the unions as well.
One of the big issues at the moment, of course, is that the Labour Party is pretty much stony broke. And they've got a meeting with the trade unions later this month. Feeling is that the unions may put a price on their support, their financial support for Labour. And, Brown came to the back of the plane and laid down the law in no uncertain terms, saying that there'd be no return to the 1970s when it came to union rights and no retreat from modernisation, absolutely no question of any reintroduction of secondary picketing. I mean, his argument was that the unions would be the more interested in talking about family-friendly employment rights and so on, and the sort of softer end of trade unionism. Whether that is the case remains to be seen, of course. But he certainly was adamant that he was not going to do any sorts of deals with the unions which would restore to them the powers that were taken away by Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s.
For more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/politics. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, phew, what a scorcher. Global warming means even hotter summers down under. The torrid truth at guardian.co.uk/Australia. There's a headless Hitler at guardian.co.uk/Germany. Facebook is refusing to recognise civil partnerships. Find out your status at guardian.co.uk/technology. The French say zut alors as snail prices soar. Take your time over the story at guardian.co.uk/food. If your bedroom walls are covered with pictures of Zac Efron or Vanessa Anne Hudgens, may we interest you in a review of High School Musical at guardian.co.uk/arts. Plus, you can catch up on an enthralling weekend at Wimbledon, guardian.co.uk/sport. Next today, the Tories have a plan to win you over. It involves charging less for petrol, although sometimes they'll charge you more. The Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, says when times are tough, they'll share our pain at the petrol pump, but when times are good, they'll take a little bit extra. We spoke to our Westminster correspondent, David Henke, to try and clarify what the Tories are talking about.
Well, they're basically saying if you had a Conservative government now, you would be paying about 5p less a litre for your petrol, because they've devised an idea that when petrol prices and diesel prices go up, the share that goes to the Treasury goes up as well. What they're proposing is to make this a flat figure so it doesn't go up, and therefore the price of diesel and petrol basically isn't so badly affected by the oil price hike as it would have been. There is a catch in this, though. If the price comes down, and given that some of the present oil prices are thought to be speculation, the Conservatives will claw back more of it, so petrol won't go down as much as it would have done under Labour. So under Labour, it goes up more with the taxes and will come down again. Under the Tories, it wouldn't go up so much, but it wouldn't come down so much either.
And when the Tories are clawing back some of this money, will they then say, actually, we've got as much tax as Labour would have done, we'll stop clawing it back, or are they happy to keep on clawing?
Basically, in better times, they want to keep some of the money there. But really, the problem about all this is that the Treasury needs the money from this extra petrol tax rise, so they tell us. And they say it'd be grossly irresponsible if, in fact, they didn't get this extra money while other taxes are going down because there's less activity in the economy. And the result will be that the Tories would have to find some other way to raise taxes to compensate the motorists. The Tories disagree with this, by the way.
Well, Labour claim that the Tories are going to have to find £3 billion. The Tories, what, they believe that it's all going to be tax neutral, do they?
The Tories say, well, it'll be tax neutral because we don't really need this, we shouldn't need this extra money from petrol prices going up. Labour are saying, oh no, it's not as simple as this, and we've costed this out. And it's even got to a stage that both sides are using rival independent think tanks. The Tories are saying, we are backed by the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, who've looked at this and says, yes, the Treasury is getting extra money. The government say no. If you look up the Institute for Fiscal Studies, they'll tell you this isn't the case. So not only can the parties not agree, but neither can the think tanks.
And is this then going to put Labour on a back foot because they've got the by-election coming up, haven't they, to think about?
Yeah, I think it's going to put Labour on... it's going to contribute to Labour on the back foot. The Labour Party position in Glasgow, which is supposed to be a safe seat at the moment, is totally dire. They were supposed to have selected a candidate who has just stood down. They're having to select another candidate who is a MSP. All the other parties have got their candidates. Labour are trailing in the polls in England to the Tories and trailing in the polls in Scotland to the Scot Nats. The Scot Nats have launched a ferocious campaign there, and frankly, if they lose there, people are saying Gordon Brown's job is in jeopardy because they shouldn't lose.
The Guardian's Westminster correspondent David Henke. I'm Mike Duran. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, English Heritage say we're heading for cultural disaster as the developers eye up Britain's historical battlegrounds.
It's a real crime against history to take these things away. The pieces themselves are worth very little. The history that you destroy in it is literally priceless.
But first, a view from both sides of the West Bank barrier. In a special report from our Middle East correspondent, we take a look at the lives of Palestinians and Israelis rent by a barrier of barbed wire. Deemed to be there to protect lives, the blockade is putting livelihoods at risk, as we hear from The Guardian's Rory McCarthy.
On a hilltop in the occupied West Bank is the Palestinian village of Jayus, an important stretch of fertile farmland that sits on one of the area's main water aquifers. But the people of Jayus say their village is dying. The problems began 5 years ago with the arrival of what Israel calls its security fence. Here it is a 50-meter-wide barrier of barbed wire, electronic fencing and patrol roads. It slices through the heart of Jayus's land, cutting off the homes of the village from their farmland and greenhouses. Around two-thirds of the village's land is now on the western or Israeli side of the barrier and accessible only to the few with permits, and only through two gates, which each open for around an hour, three times a day. Sharif Omar is one of the few farmers lucky enough to have a permit, although it took him years to obtain and lasts only 3 months. When it runs out at the end of July, he'll have to apply again. He says the barrier is squeezing the life out of Jayus.
If Jayus will lose more than 70% of their land, this means you ask Jayus people to migrate and to get out of the village, because you can't continue. Jayus is an agriculture village, and it's well known that it's the basket food of this area. If we will lose this land and these farms, how can we resist? How can we survive? How can we go on? And they talk about peace.
Israel says its barrier is purely for security, to defend its population against terrorist attacks and the scourge of suicide bombings. However, 4 years ago this week, the International Court of Justice said in an advisory opinion that where the barrier crossed into the West Bank, it was illegal and should be taken down. Israel has not accepted that decision and continues to build the barrier, which is now more than half finished. Eventually, it will stretch to 720 kilometres, around 450 miles. There is another side to the story of the barrier. Just a couple of kilometres away from Jayus is a large Jewish settlement called Alfei Menashe. It's still in the West Bank, but this time on the Israeli side of the barrier. Alfei Menashe is home to about 7,000 people and boasts comfortable hillside houses, neatly maintained lawns, thousands of trees, and a large sports centre with two swimming pools. Contractors are busy building more houses and apartments to meet the growing demand for property. When the barrier was first proposed, it was going to leave Alfei Menashe beyond its reach. But the settlement lobbied hard, and the path of the barrier was changed. Now, Alfei Menashe is surrounded by the electronic fence, with its patrol roads and barbed wire, and as a result, is convinced it will become part of Israel in any future peace deal. In fact, its residents no longer talk of themselves as settlers. The mayor of Alfei Menashe is Eliezer Hisdai. It was he who worked hard to move the barrier to include the settlement on the Israeli side. Like many from Israel's political right wing, Hisdai argues that the Jewish people have what he calls an ancestral and biblical right to live in the West Bank. He calls the settlers real Zionists. But he says he's modified his opinions because of the changing reality and now says he accepts there have to be eventually two states, an Israeli state that will include some but not all the Jewish settlements living next to a Palestinian state. And it seems obvious to him and to others that it is the West Bank barrier that will divide them.
Our observation of the ever-changing reality is that we will not be able to live together. I definitely accept the demographic problem that would be created and the humanitarian problem. You really have to look at it in a very sober way and understand that something needs to happen. So, okay, we're going to separate from our ancestral right, and when the time comes, it will be impossible to prevent the other state beside us, the Palestinian state.
The Guardian's Middle East correspondent, Rory McCarthy, reporting from the West Bank. And for everything you need to know about the conflict, go to guardian.co.uk/world. Next, to the muddy battlefields of Britain, where developers are drooling at the prospect of building houses where once great armies fought their last fight. English Heritage will tomorrow warn that 43 sites nationwide are at risk from the excavators. But historians and archaeologists are also worried about the men and women who like to spend their weekends with a hot flask and a metal detector. The Guardian's Maeve Kennedy has been given exclusive access to the at-risk list.
Of all the thousands of battles that were fought in England, there's really only a handful, 43, for thousands of years of history, where the site has survived in a recognisable form and they've managed to identify exactly where the battle was fought and the battle itself was of some significance. One of the battlefields which will be named as at risk is Towton in Yorkshire, where there was a ferocious battle, the bloodiest ever on English soil, which the Lancastrians lost comprehensively, and it led to the coronation of Edward IV. So that was a battle you could call a real hinge of history.
I'm concerned now, Maeve, that you and I are both guilty, having mentioned Towton, that we're going to encourage the next horde of metal detectors.
I think this terrifies the archaeologists. Indeed, one archaeologist said to me he dreads the name being mentioned in print because he knows that they'll come again. You must get permission from the farmers before you use a metal detector on privately owned land. Furthermore, when the Heritage Bill, which is still trailing through Parliament, it probably certainly won't come in this session, it might just make it in the next session, comes in, there will be a new requirement that you get a specific licence for a registered battlefield, and that licence will be given grudgingly and with an absolute requirement that you report exactly where you found, what you found. There is already a voluntary reporting scheme for archaeological finds called Portable Antiquities. Sometimes, with the best will in the world, people report more or less where they found things on a battlefield where you're trying to work out exactly where people moved, where was the charge, where did people fall back, where did one side start to lose and the other side win. Literally, feet can make a difference to understanding what actually happened. I was told that from Towton quite recently, a little scrap of metal, a little enamelled badge from Lord Grey's horse was found and has since been sold. It must have come from Towton, the archaeologists think. There's been some debate as to whether there were two Lord Grey there, but whether they were actually in the thick of the fighting or not, or whether the aristocrats frequently do at battlefields, whether they stood on the sidelines on comfortable high ground and got the hell out when they saw things were getting nasty. This little tiny enamel scrap could prove precisely where he was on the battlefield, but the find spot hasn't been recorded, and so that piece of information is lost forever. I think it's a real crime against our history. Your history, actually. I'm Irish, but we're very interested in this particular one from the sidelines. It's a real crime against history to take these things away. The pieces themselves are worth very little. The history that you destroy in it is literally priceless.
I guess if developments were constructed, it would be rough justice for the ghost of Edward IV to haunt the new housing estates, wouldn't it?
Yes. There are, of course, accounts of battlefield ghosts. There are very famous ones from Naseby and Marsden Moor. There are lots of stories of ghosts being seen around the edges of Towton and Saxton, the other village at the other end of the line, which wouldn't be at all surprising. There are very good contemporary accounts. I mean, the appalling thing about this battle was it was fought in a snowstorm. So you've got thousands of men, up to 30,000 men, up to perhaps 50,000 men. One account says 200,000 men, certainly enormous crowds of men fighting half blinded by the snow. And the slaughter was so great that at the end of the day, the snow started to melt, and the melt snow was so saturated with blood that there are accounts of every furrow, every ditch, and the little streams that ran along the side of the battlefield literally being dyed crimson like water running from a dye works, from human blood. So if there weren't a few ghosts around in Towton, it's hard to imagine where they would be.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Finally, after a British success in the girls' tennis, thanks to 14-year-old Laura Robson, we can celebrate another British success, this time at the Grand Prix, thanks to a slightly older Lewis Hamilton. Starting fourth on the grid, the 23-year-old took charge in the wet conditions to win what he describes as definitely the best race he's ever won. Guardian chief sports writer Richard Williams was at Silverstone to watch Hamilton's heroics.
Rain is the thing that separates the really great racing drivers from the rest. There's a category of Grand Prix drivers known as rain masters who have always been held in a special kind of veneration. And it goes back a long way. You know, Stirling Moss was one. And Lewis Hamilton absolutely joined that very, very exclusive club. What he did was produce a drive of enormous virtuosity in very, very difficult conditions. There were conditions that caught out almost everybody else in the race. You know, people were spinning all over the place. The race started with Felipe Massa in the lead of the World Championship. Well, Massa managed to spin off at virtually every corner of the track and finish last, 13th, last of the finishers, which puts Hamilton's performance into some kind of perspective. His performance wasn't flawless. He had two tiny little incidents when, you know, it might have ended worse, but he controlled extremely well. He found that when the conditions were at their worst and there were intermittent showers all day, his visor was misting up and he was having to open it at certain corners in order to, you know, to get the, to remove the fogging so that he could see where he was going. And yet still, you know, a lot of the time, particularly towards the end, he was lapping seconds faster than anybody else in the field. And he finished more than a minute ahead of Nick Heidfeld in second place. And by the end of the race, he'd lapped all but the next two finishers. Rubens Barrichello was third. So, you know, it was just absolutely complete and, you know, awe-inspiring performance, you would have to say.
He hasn't been having a particularly good time at the moment, has he? And with that as a backdrop, would you say this is his finest hour?
Very much so. He's had a rotten 2 or 3 weeks in several respects. The last two races at Montreal and Manicourt have been very bad for him. Coming after that wonderful win in Monaco, he's been making small mistakes. People have been questioning whether his commitment to promotional activities and to his commitments to his sponsors have been, damaging his concentration. You know, racing drivers need to be absolutely on it all the time. They need to be thinking about what they're doing. And, you know, going off to meet Nelson Mandela and going off, you know, making some sponsor happy by going on a sailboat and all kinds of things that he's been doing. And even in the last week, you know, people suspected were contributing towards some of the little mistakes he's been making. But you have to say, hands down, he answered every criticism that's been made of him and then some.
But also good team tactics, because
yep,
unlike Ferrari, they didn't change to wet tyres, did they?
No, they kept their intermediates on, and it proved exactly right. I mean, they got all their tactics right. You know, they got their refueling strategy right. They got the tyre strategy right. And, but you have to say, most of all, it was Hamilton's ability to, you know, find his way between the puddles and, and drive extremely fast while not doing the stupid things that some of the other drivers were doing. You know, that's with the backup of the team, of course. That's what did it. It was enormously impressive.
And finally, down at Silverstone at the weekend, you've been competing with the Brazilian commentators, haven't you?
Poor Brazilian commentators who had to explain why Felipe Massa kept falling off the track, going, "Oh, Felipe Massa, oh, speed, oh, oh," that kind of thing. They're just the same as they are at football.
Thanks to Speedy Gonzalez at Silverstone. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Andrew Duckworth and Philip Maynard. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Duran.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.